We are reconvened. We're going to hear the 2:30 docket in which we have the, in the interest of JCBP matter. Counsel, you may proceed.
If the police report, my name is James Dodd. I'm attorney for the appellant, the respondent in the case below, and the father. And I will be referring to him as the father during the course of my discussion and to the opposing party as the mother in order to keep from getting too confused in this process. Briefly, the statement of the case is this. This is a paternity action filed by the mother and the Department of Social Services in 2004, which finally ended up with a permanent parenting plan adopted by the court in 2007. This parenting plan gave father a primary care and custody of the minor child. The mother was authorized parenting time on alternate weekends. Things stood here for a very short period of time when the Department of Social Services filed a dependency and neglect petition arising out of circumstances, conditions, and events that took place at the mother's home. This then left the case, the paternity case, pending because the matter had been certified to the juvenile court in the dependency case. In 2009, the parties reached a stipulation after the conclusion of 2 years of whatever they did over there, we don't know. And at that point in time, the May 12, 2009, the dependency court entered a parenting time plan with a 50-50 parenting time schedule. This was then certified back to the paternity court on July 23rd, 2009. October 2009, mother files a motion to modify child support because child support had previously been ordered on the basis of father having sole custody as the guidelines talk about. Well, this motion didn't get to hearing right away because another problem blew up. And father ended up filing several contempt motions and then a motion to modify custody again. And the trial judge, in this case a magistrate, on April 13, 2010, entered an order again granting father sole custody, sole physical custody. Now he used the term full custody in his order, but granting father sole physical custody of the child. Mother was authorized to have parenting time supervised for 1 hour twice a week. And this is where things stayed, with some minor adjustments in the parenting time order, which did not change the basic concept of father being the primary sole custodian, physical custodian of the child, until February 22nd, 2012, when the court finally heard and decided the father's motion to modify custody, denying it, thereby reinstating the 50-50 parenting plan that had been part of the resolution of the delinquency case 2 years earlier. Mother then filed a motion to modify child support in October 2012. Then what happened is they scheduled mother's October 2009 motion to modify child support for hearing on December 3rd. The case was heard. However, father didn't personally appear, and his attorney didn't show up at the hearing. The record indicates that apparently the attorney had made some arrangement, ill-fated as it turned out, to participate by telephone. However, there was some problem with the number. Petitioner was told by his attorney to wait at home and he would be conferenced in, otherwise he would have been there. Well, the court proceeded then with a hearing without the petitioner's counsel or petitioner present. and thereby entered an order, one, setting child support at $704 a month, and making it retroactive to the date the motion was filed, despite the fact that the child had been living with the father in a sole custody situation from April 2010 until February 2012, 22 months. Father was ordered to pay child support, although he was the one who had custody of the child.
Mr. Dodd, let's talk a moment and kind of look at some of these issues, because if there is no excusable neglect, Magistrate Torrington's order was in fact supported by the evidence presented at that time. Isn't that correct?
I disagree.
Okay, why don't you expand on
that? Okay. If you review the transcript, there wasn't a single witness called, no witness was sworn, and no witness ever testified. Furthermore, there wasn't a single exhibit marked, identified, authenticated, offered, or introduced into evidence. What we have, if you look at it, is a hearing that turns out to be kind of a colloquy between mother's attorney, the Department of Social Services attorney, and the magistrate. And the attorney for the department says, I got these documents, and just kind of sets them up there. They're not even in the portion of the file where the exhibits are supposed to be. If you look for them, you won't find them. Now, there appears to be three or four pages of documents buried in the main file, which may or may not be the documents that's referred to in the transcript. I'm not willing to speculate whether those are the documents the court relied upon or not. But again, the basic rules of evidence were not observed in any fashion in this proceeding. Mother was asked questions to which she provided responses, but she was never sworn. Attorneys were providing evidence in lieu of having witnesses or documents. And so, and my point there is that had mother's attorney been there, had any attorney for an opposing party been there, they certainly would have raised these issues of, wait a minute, we've got to have proper evidentiary foundations, let's have some witnesses, let's have testimony, let's have something in the way of evidence that the court can make its decision on. She wasn't there. And she wasn't there, I submit, because of gross negligence. There is no rule, no statute, no custom that I have come across which says that an attorney for a party may absent themselves from an evidentiary hearing. Now, there are provisions for initial status conferences. There are provisions for motions hearings where there is no evidence. But I'm talking about what amounts to a trial, and that the attorney and the party are permitted to participate by telephone. If one just compares the rules regarding absent witness testimony, what has to happen? Well, we have to be sure we have a right phone number. Well, we didn't have a right phone number. How to get a hold of these people, what they're going to testify to, what the issues are, what exhibits. None of that was done. This was apparently done at a last minute for reasons which the record doesn't give us an explanation.
Well, Mr. Dodd, let me ask this. How can malpractice, no matter how bad it is, constitute grounds under 60B5?
Well, the case law indicates that in fact, a party who is prejudiced by the misfeasance or malfeasance, so we'll say misfeasance in this case, of their attorney in a circumstance which they can't control, okay, that is excusable neglect from the position of the party. It's not excusable neglect from the position of the attorney. I'm not trying to excuse the attorney here, but here we have a layperson relying on a member of the bar who we've licensed and said, you know, you can rely on this person.
Well, I'm not talking about ineffective assistance of counsel. What I'm talking about is all of the provisions of 60B that warrant the court to throw out a hearing and to give a new one on some basis. Fraud, mistake, all those specifics that are set forth in the rule. And there's a catch-all. And it seems to me that this can only come under the catch-all, which is essentially any other reason justifying relief. Do you have a case that says that malpractice satisfies 60B5?
The cases cited in my brief on under this section do in fact stand for the proposition that negligence or gross negligence, a failure to file a pleading on time, is one of the examples. It can in fact amount to excusable neglect. And here we have an attorney who I can only describe as willfully decided to ignore her responsibilities to be in court at a time for a hearing which she had notice of. That's not in dispute.
Doesn't the record reflect just carelessness? There was an effort to connect. The proceeding was delayed 40 minutes. She called in an hour later. It's for sure careless, but is it gross negligence?
I submit that the failure to be there, that this purported arrangement to participate by telephone is the negligence. The other problems that arise, communicated telephone number, the issues of whether they could get a hold of her or not, grew out of the attorney's initial negligent act and decision, and that was to not appear at the hearing. And then the decision not to appear and then to in fact not appear. That was the negligence. That was the misfeasance, if you want to call it. Whether you want to call it negligent misfeasance, gross misfeasance, to me it amounts to willful misfeasance. Because that's her job. That's her responsibility to a client. That's her responsibility to the court. Now, I'd like to reserve some time, so I'd like to get to my third issue, if you don't mind, and that is this issue of the retroactive child support. The court seemed to just simply go back and make the child support retroactive, either to the date the motion was filed. Either the court was completely unaware that the child had actually been living with the father, or the court chose, the juvenile court judge chose to say, well, these were just temporary orders. A distinction without a difference. An order is an order is an order. The order was that the child stop the 50-50 parenting time and live with dad on a full-time basis. Mom gets to see him infrequently. That remained in effect for 22 months, to put him in a position of having to pay child support for a time when actually mom should have been paying him child support because he's the one with the child, is both unfair and unjust. And 1410.122 clearly provides that a retroactive child support order can be avoided if it would be unfair and unjust. And in this case, nothing is more fair and unjust than to be paying child support after you've already had the sole responsibility for taking care of the child. So if I could reserve the balance of my time.
All right, Mr. Don.
If it pleases the court, Steve Thompson, number 28861 of the Justice and Mercy Legal Aid Clinic, on behalf of appellee Karen Bates, who is not present. Thank you for considering the arguments this afternoon. Counsel just said perhaps the court was completely unaware of the parenting situation. It's my understanding that what is being appealed here is Judge Karen Ashby's order of the magistrate's review. And Judge Ashby stated in her order, I have reviewed the motion, the file, and the record. I believe her. and I believe you should too. She was intimately involved in this case for 3 years. She was involved in all of the litigious proceedings. She was involved in the parenting time in that interim when mom did not have parenting time. That was not by mother's choice. That was based on motions that from the very beginning, if you've reviewed the record, and I know someone has, mother said were frivolous and groundless and vexatious. And the result, the fact that she had a period of time when she did not have her 50-50 parenting time were based on allegations that were not true and that were found to be not true by Judge Ashby in 2 days of hearing. She was intimately aware of what was going on here. There is, my experience in doing these cases, child support cases, is it's not unusual for the department to be there. The department, unfortunately, did not have a sworn financial statement updated from father. He had an opportunity to do that. The Child Support Enforcement Division had to go with what they had, which was the Department of Labor Statistics. There was nothing that mother did or could have done to make sure that anything more was placed on the record. It is not unusual for the magistrate to ask the department what information you have, to ask the attorney with the client there as an offer of proof about what is your income. She was not employed at the time. We did not argue that she should not be imputed income. We agreed to that. There was nothing inappropriate that was done by the magistrate, and in reviewing that, that's what Judge Ashby stated.
Well, Mr. Thompson, I guess the question I have here is, for purposes of a 60B, is it appropriate to say, look, this is a reason that justifies relief. That's why I should get a new hearing. And the reason that justifies relief is, I wasn't represented. I wanted to be represented. I had counsel, Leonard, and appearance, but I didn't even get the process of having an objection, of asking the witnesses be sworn, asking the foundations be laid for exhibits. And that seems to be a pretty basic process if you're considering due process.
Anyway, I appreciate that, Your Honor. My response to that would be, in order for us to accept, for you to consider what they're claiming is an excusable neglect, you must, without any rebuttal from Letha Holden, who was the attorney at the time, from Karen Patton, from anyone, that father actually, his side of the story is actually what happened. The court tried to call father. He was not new to litigation. He had been involved in litigation for a long time. He filed numerous motions. That's the reason that he filed motions to continue this thing. That's why it was such a long period of time when mom didn't have any parent time. As a matter of fact, in terms of not being represented, when the every other week parenting time order was entered, that was an agreement of Ms. Patton, because on that date, she did not have representation. She was not going to get anything but supervised parenting time unless she agreed to what he said he would agree to. She didn't have representation for that. Now, I don't know where Mr. Bates was. I know that they tried to call him, and I know that he didn't answer.
Mr. Thompson, I understand what you're saying in terms of excusable neglect, but when I think of excusable neglect, I think of it in terms of why a pleading should be allowed to be filed late. On the other hand, when I think of reasons that justify relief under 60B-5, it does seem, although I can't put my finger on a case, that a lawyer's malpractice might satisfy.
I'm not familiar with any law that states that. And in regard to just, again, I believe that father knew what he was doing and that he knew he should be present at that hearing. I can't prove that. He can't prove that he didn't know it. In regard to the public policy behind that, really what this kind of boils down to from appellee's position is appellant kind of agrees that if what father says is correct, then attorney was negligent. He should sue his attorney. Judge Ashby knows from this case very well that he's extremely litigious. And appellee's perspective, what she's experienced, is dad doesn't trust mom. That's what Judge Ashby's order said. They don't communicate well together. He doesn't trust her. He is not burdened by his child support order. As a matter of fact, even if you take the evidence and a lot favorable to him, it's not going to change it incredibly in terms of the monthly amount. Your arrears will make a difference. And it will make a difference that is not in the best interest of the child that this case is about. Mom continues to be indigent. Dad has, according to the record, $9,000 a month of income. That's a gross inequity in terms of trying to redo what, under the law, should not be redone. I'm not familiar with anything, as the court said, that indicates that this malpracticing lawyer is qualifies under Rule 60. And I believe that Judge Ashby was sound in her decision and her review of the file. And I believe that she was very intimately involved with these parties and she knew what was going on. And her order is sound and it should stand. The argument in the opening brief referred to undue hardship and injustice. And from Kelly's position, it would be undue hardship and injustice for this order to be reversed. I'm a civil legal aid lawyer, and you guys are probably familiar with the Supreme Court's commission on civil legal justice, and they call it a crisis in civil legal justice. And part of the crisis is based on situations like this, where one party who has significant resources uses the legal process to bludgeon someone who does not have them. That's what's happened in this case over and over again. That's what the delays were all about. That's why it took us more than 2 years to get to a hearing that then took 2 days that Ms. Patton didn't have any money to pay an attorney for. It would be unjust to overturn this ruling that the court, who was very intimately involved in it, made a sound decision under the law regarding it. Unless you have any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Don?
Yes, Your Honor, I'd like to correct a couple of things and then conclude. First of all, this idea that the judge determined that the allegations made by the father in the latest proceedings over parenting time were untrue, that's just patently false. The judge found that his allegations were true, they just weren't sufficient to meet the criteria for a modification of parenting time, which she put as child endangerment. She went through each of them and said, yes, this is true, yes, this is true, but individually or combined, they are insufficient to support a modification of the 50-50 parenting time. Well, we can talk a lot about a lot of things, but and if you look at the file, you will see that for most of this time that this case has been pending since 2004, father was unrepresented. Everything that was filed pro se. It's only in recent years that he's been able to afford an attorney. Has it been litigious? Has it been a battle? Yes. Because if you look at the record, he believes mom is unfit to have time with the child. There are two issues before we're getting to a conclusion. The Rule 60B motion, and then the issue of retroactive child support. The new trial, the trial court, the juvenile court, only considered one criteria, excusable neglect. We can talk about, well, does he have Does he have a defense, and is it equitable? Well, the trial court never got there. And if the counsel believes that there's other evidence, the trial court could, upon remand, conduct a hearing. But here the trial court erred by simply making a wrong determination on excusable neglect and never got to the other two issues.
Mr. Dodd, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Mr. Thompson. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.